Hello and welcome to episode 24 of the Roy Harper podcast for July 2009. In this show, a brief news update, an interview with Nigel Maslin-Jones, part one of two, the A to Z of Harper, this time it's the letter W, listener feedback and the usual wide selection of music. Kicking off with some news first of all, Nick Harper's been busy performing some gigs in Norway, and later on for the next couple of months he's going to be gigging around Italy, Scotland and the north of England, leading up to some dates in the USA in September. Now if any of those sound like that might be interesting for you, go to www.harperspace.com and go for his gig news update and you'll see where he's performing. Those of you in the US particularly might be interested in getting the chance to see Nick play live. In other news, Roy's birthday was on the 12th of June and he turned 68, so a slightly belated very happy birthday to Roy on that. Now I've actually been exchanging a couple of emails with him. Some of you that go to the stormcock.net will have seen that I've been posting there about my attempts at beer making lately. When I was a late teenager, I suppose, I started doing beer making at home from kits. This was back in the late 70s, early 80s. And at the time, the stuff was pretty awful, actually, to be frank, but I had another go towards the end of last year with kits again, which are basically big tins of malt extract and hop extract that you add water to and ferment through. And I was very impressed with the quality of it, but as communications have got a lot better these days, I found a home brewing forum and found lots of people talking very enthusiastically about all grain brewing, which is basically buying the malt and hops as the raw ingredients and doing the whole mashing, which is converting out to sugars from the malt and adding in the hops and boiling them up and getting the bitterness right and then fermenting. It's a very long involved process and I've done three of them so far. It takes about all day to do a brew, although a lot of it is waiting around. But anyway, I started talking to Roy about beer making and I'm trying to get him interested enough to actually have a go. So I thought it might be actually quite amusing to try and think if he made up his own beer, what he might want to call it. Now, of course, those of you in the UK will remember the crappy Harp Lager. And it's one of the most insipid, weak, horrible concoctions you could imagine. And I wouldn't want that to be associated with the Harper name at all, so we won't have a Harper Lager or anything of that sort. Let's assume he's going to make a quality English bitter style. What might we call it? If you've got any ideas, write in. I'd like to see what you can come up with. I'm really excited this month about the interview. Not least because I don't actually do the interview. We've got, as well as Nigel Maslin-Jones as the interviewee, we have a guest interviewer in the form of John Cholmondeley. And John has been a long-time subscriber to Stormcock on the old mailing list and also, of course, on the newer website. And he knows Nigel reasonably well and offered to interview him for me. And I, of course, thought, well, that's fantastic. But for once, people won't have to listen to my voice for a whole hour or however long we stick it on there for. And John went off and finally set up the interview with Maslin, which he did over the phone, and I think he's come up with something absolutely amazing. There's a good connection between the two of them, but John has also taken a really good step of interleaving some of Nigel's tunes in amongst the interview, and it really breaks it up nicely and makes it very interesting to listen to and less kind of fatiguing than some of the long dialogues that I've probably done before. So I think you're going to really enjoy that. Now, if you don't know who Nigel Maslin-Jones is, he is a musician who's been around for quite a while, probably mainly known as an acoustic guitar player and singer, but also has some other strings to his bow as well. But his connection with Roy is that he guested on Roy's Once album, and he's credited in the album as additional guitar on both the title track Once and also on the track Sleeping at the Wheel. So we're going to play that Sleeping at the Wheel track now from the Once album, and then we'll go straight into the interview.
through the window. Just a wall, shapes are forming, blackbirds call. Early morning spirits moving hands, tick-tocking ages in the half light of the still before the lark. Where I can feel my shadow touch your silence in the dark. Sleeping at the wheel, sleeping at the wheel, reaching for oceans before us to feel together tonight. Play an eagle, fire and ice, ever willing, sweet surprise. Welling in the belly of that chase, tracing out the angel in the half light on your face before the lark. Where I can feel my shadow touch your silence in the dark. Sleeping at the wheel, sleeping at the wheel, reaching for oceans before us to feel together tonight. Then suddenly I hear you say, time to get up, gone midday. Cup of tea, love, and I realize I must have dropped off, drifted into a dream before the lark. Yielded to the ether of our secret world in the dark. Sleeping at the wheel, sleeping at the wheel, sleeping at the wheel, reaching for oceans for us to feel together tonight, 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 reaching for oceans for us to feel together. Tonight, together, tonight, together, tonight, tonight, tonight.
Welcome to the Roy Harper podcast, and the guest for this month's episode is Nigel Maslin Jones. Welcome, Nigel.
Hello there, John.
Hi. For those of you who don't know Nigel, he is probably described, accurately described as singer, songwriter, guitarist, general musician who's worked with a lot of people you would have heard of over the years, including Roy, hence the connection and his inclusion on this broadcast. But I'll like to chat to Nigel and go through some of the history of how he got into music and how he got where he got to and why he did what he did. But before we talk about music, Nigel, we'll just start. You had an interesting earlier career. A lot of people work in factories, work in offices, and then manage to make it into the music industry. But can you just tell us about what you did before you took to music?
Yeah, I work at Jersey Zoo. otherwise known as Jersey Wildlife Conservation Trust. And that was 1969 through to 71. And when I was born and raised around the Midlands, the industrial heartlands of Britain, and I was a 50s kid. And I grew up in the shadow of Dudley Zoo, a very beautiful castle on a very beautiful hill that played quite a part with the parliamentary revolution with the roundheads and all of that, and was blown apart for its troubles. But they built a zoo around it in the 1920s. I grew up around it, and, you know, as a young lad in the late 50s, 60s, and I ended up working there part-time, and always loved animals and Mother Nature to pieces, just in the bloodstream, I suppose. And so I did years of part-time work at Dudley Zoo when I was at school and just started playing guitar and stuff, and eventually the bug got me and I got offered a job at Jersey Zoo, and I went there to work with the great apes. So I worked with some lovely gorillas, chimpanzees and orangutans, plus lots and lots of other mammals and small monkeys and things. And
so
it was an amazing time.
A logical progression into the music industry then?
Absolutely, yeah, dealing with gorillas. I don't think it fully equipped me for the gorillas that I came across later, but a constant theme through my life, really, animals and Mother Nature. It's something in my bloodstream, probably a bit like some of the music, really, because I was thinking when you were saying about doing this interview, my roots, and realistically I owe my roots to the bloodstream and the genetics in my family. I had a grandfather that I never knew, because he passed away just before I was born, and he's always fascinated me. Historically, I look like him, and he was a semi-professional violinist, and he'd go as far as playing in the dark in order to be able to hear the notes of the instrument better. I never knew him, but of course my mother, his daughter, became a really good pianist. Although she didn't play much around me when I was a teenager growing. She was busy being one of those hard-working industrial mothers. But there is music in the family. So the love of nature seems to go in the family. So I'm only following my hereditary roots, really.
Oh, well, good. Can't say further than that. So how did you then move to Cornwall in the early 70s to take up a career as a musician?
Well, there was a bit of a sort of cathartic happening when I was in Jersey Zoo. I got news after 2 years that my father was ill with cancer. It kind of forced me into coming back to the mainland, as we called it, to the industrial Midlands to support my mother. I was there for a year and a half. I'd always had a love affair with Cornwall going on from when I was 14. One of the first musics I really fell in love with was the lifestyle and music of the early Donovan first couple of years, when Donovan was trying to be a beatnik and dossing around in Cornwall, a place I'd been to a lot as a tiny child with my parents. And it sort of linked something up about water and nature, because when I was a kid, and we used to come back from Cornwall from a holiday from, say, Mevagissey or somewhere, I remember one year when I was about seven, I threw my father's car keys over the cliff in order to stop us returning to the industrial Midlands. It didn't work, but Cornwall always had a pull. And when Donovan came out with an album called Fairy Tale, his second album, a lot of the songs were some of his best, I think. They captured a real coastal otherworldly kind of magic to them, and they were very gentle songs. And to me, at 14 or 15 years of age, gentle music in a quite an ungentle area called the Midlands, because it was a very brutal place in many ways. But Donovan and Cornwall, and I don't know, there was something about beatniks that had always rung the bell with me, and the beat poetry, Jack Kerouac, and there were influences coming across the channel from America of the beat generation. And then suddenly Dylan broke out, and I'd been listening to things like, and being really transported by things like Eddie Cochran was just brilliant when I was really young. The Shadows were fantastic when we were 10, 11, 12. Then the Beatles and Dylan and hit us, and suddenly there was all this folk music opening out that was happening in Britain. Tom Paxton, and there were early moves afoot. There were folk clubs everywhere playing all sorts of I don't know, I'd say that really the folk songs contained really the social history of the working classes. I didn't know about union history and trade union history and the events of how it was for people, seafarers and miners and the people who built the railways across America. And the music really led on, the folk music that we heard at primary school, the simple songs that teachers would, the melodies always completely overwhelmed me. Some of them, there was something about music that if it had something about it, would just sort of fill me up, really. So I suppose I was kind of destined to, I ended up singing a lot, you know, for bits and pieces in school. And there was all this other stuff coming across the channel as the 60s ploughed on, and it was a revolution. I mean, I can't say that it, looking back on it, I mean, I know it seems like the hippie generation was really the more of the aristocratic elite with the money down in the home counties, and we were up in the provinces of Britain and places like the Midlands, but that the ethics still swept through us young people as each generation's vibe does, and it really impressed me as a young kid. I'd been working part-time at Dudley Zoo, and when I reached 19, I was busting to get out of the Midlands, and I'd been offered a job at Jersey because of my part-time work at Dudley, and I went and lived there for 2 years. Funnily enough, that's really where I cut my musical teeth in Jersey properly, because I soon ended up playing a couple of nights a week in the small bars in the posher hotels, where they'd have a posh cabaret in the big bit, and they'd have a couple of bars with singers like me in. And the first job I got was a job that the Humble Bums, as they were called at the time, had just stopped doing. They had a residency at a pub in Jersey. They'd stopped doing it that year, and I took over. Of course, the Humble Bums was Jerry Rafferty and, the amazing comedian I can't think of.
Billy Connolly?
Thank you very much.
I thought so. Interesting combination, those two.
And I never saw them on Jersey, but I always looked back on it and thought, bloody hell, I was just 1 year behind you, buggers. When I was in Jersey, I saw a sitar in a music room window. And although I didn't get on with my family back home very much, my mother had told my father, and I don't know why, but he put his hands in his pocket and he paid for this quite expensive sitar for me. And when I came back to the Midlands when he was ill, I was messing about with, when I was playing, I mean, the house was full of an ill man, if you know what I mean, but I was getting out on the occasional nights to the odd folk clubs in the Midlands and just doing experimental things that I love to do with sitar and 12-string. It didn't really make me be taken on by the traditional folkies, if you know what I mean. Because there's this long-haired, bearded git with a sitar and a 12-string.
Yeah. In Dudley.
insisting on writing his own songs, which are obviously crap, you know. In fact, I remember one bloke saying once to me, what have y'all come back here for? Y'all should get yourself a proper job and get down the production line at Longbridge. They need people like you. But it wasn't to be, really. By about 70, late 72... early 73, I popped up and down to Cornwall to see an old friend of mine called Dan Foam, and he pretty much taught me my first finger-picking style when I was 15. He was he still is a fantastic guitarist. He was professional for many years with a band called Bronco, who had quite good international acclaim, with a guitarist called Kevin Gammond. And for a while, Dan Foam did quite a stint of working with Clifford T. Ward, a name that some of your listeners might remember with great fondness, who produced some beautiful material and sadly left us quite early, I think. But Clifford T. Ward and Bronco were the bands that Dan was in, and Dan was really the person who very kindly turned me on to how to play acoustic guitar with a bit more sophistication than just hitting it, you know. When I'd moved to Cornwall, I'd really got to grips with playing bars and folk clubs, anywhere to keep, you know, the bills being paid. But I was doing more and more of my own material until by about 74, I pretty much stopped doing anybody else's songs, because my own kind of taken over. And it kind of led on to the first album, really, which was out in 76, but that was called Ship to Shore. Well, so, ironically, that's been re-released in the last few years, and there's some extra tracks on there.
Yeah, that's become a cult folk classic, as according to the likes of Mojo.
Of adventure, we came searching for the tides, just to carry us all seaward, too far and too wide. She said, young man, the war is over, won't you look at this dawning of day, and all the hatred is finished. There's nothing left for you to pay. And I've seen her wheeling arrows, and I've seen her raping these lands. Now she's resting, and oh so gladly, for morning is near at hand. So all searching will be over, and all striving falls in place. Social position and money matters, all be a sad disgrace. And those who hate it will be loving, those who kill will be the lamb, and those who lie will be in sorrow, and those who love go ever on. On a singularly fine day, the sun she rose and cast beams onto the sea. She was smiling for the sailors, for the dreamers and for me. And just like a ship on her journey of adventure, we came searching for the tides, just to carry us all seaward, to far and to wide. We'll be right back.
by about 74, 75, I was doing so much of my own material and doing so many gigs, I pretty much got a twitch in me to get my own album together. I've been doing lots of demos from when I was... Well, I've been playing with tape recorders, would be a better way of putting it. I wasn't doing demos to send to London so much as just getting my songs down and loving having a tape recorder from when I was about 16. And a group of friends, we used to get together, and some people who knew tape recorders, and we got a Revox and a Viacord and a few mics, and we just used to love playing music, and they were lovely people, and they loved to play the songs I was trying to write. And people like Rob Lloyd, a guy I've been friends with all my life since I was about 15 or 16, he came at music from being an electric guitarist. He was in Harry Carey and one or two quite famous people around the Midlands, late 60s. But he kind of took up acoustic guitar through meeting me, I suppose. We did the residency at the Birmingham Repertory Theatre for a year, the late night folk concerts, which are fantastic, starting at 11 o'clock at night. A great time to start acoustic music, I always think.
Yeah.
11 till 1 in the morning, brilliant. Ended the week very nicely. Rob's been a mate of mine many years, and he's on the Ship to Shore album, but he's also on the extra tracks we put on there that I found out of my archive, and with some very careful remastering we managed to rescue some very old tapes that have actually got great sort of how can I put it, great instant kind of on a wing and a prayer, everybody's playing and donating in what they feel fits the piece of music by, but it's something you don't often get in studios really when it all gets a bit kind of precious. But I really value that a lot of those recordings, and it led me on to do my own recording work quite often and develop my own little studio, because I do like that thing of being able to record whenever you feel the mood on. A luxury that in those days, really. But nowadays, many people can just go and use their computer to record, so it's no longer a kind of niche thing. Everybody can explore overdubbing and with computer recording, which is fantastic, because the more people that explore their creativity, the more brilliant music there is.
Yeah, I guess it shouldn't be about about mastering the technology.
There is a lot of problems getting over the technology, but there again, if you've got to concentrate on a challenge in front of you and it's a steep learning curve, then it's a great thing for younger people, well, older people for that matter, but I do find older friends who have been confronted. I have got still I've got three or four friends who absolutely point blank refuse to get involved in computers full stop. I can half understand and empathise with them, because I must say, I do laugh at the word virtual in relation to computing, because when I was born and raised and taught grammar, the word virtual meant when it's not quite finished yet and it doesn't quite work. As in, let me sell you this sports car, but there's only one thing about it. We've got one of the wheels missing. But we'll develop it with your help.
Yes. You can have the alpha version. So, yeah, I mean, one of Paul's favourite questions is always about the state of the recording industry and the changes in the music business. But I guess you're fairly unique, or probably under a fairly small number, and as I understand, you've always had your own label. You've always been on Isle of Light.
Yes, I have. My actual output has always ended up... there's a little story there worth telling, if you'd like to hear it.
Sure.
When I was... I don't know, I suppose 22, 23, so it'd be 1972, 3, 4. I had been going up and down to London, seeing friends of mine who lived there. I had hustled occasionally a couple of people in the music scene that I'd kind of met at gigs who encouraged me to get myself down to London and see people. And one of them became quite an important head of music publishing and moved through the publishing world. And he acted as a kind of advisor. And in 1975, I got offered a deal by a publishing house who's quite well known. But I was very naive and I had no advisor. And I'd ended up signing a 20-year deal, which, to make it legal, had my signature and two witnesses across a one-penny stamp. And a year down the line, I met a man who knew Lionel Bart. You know, the guy who wrote Oliver?
Yeah.
And then I met Lionel Bart, and he knew about this contract, and he mentioned it to me one day, and he had a look at the paperwork, and he said, "You've been stitched." He said, "You, what you've really done is sold your life away for 20 years for one penny." And it was like the story of the fantastic blues guys in the 1920s and 30s, you know, selling off their recording royalties for nothing. Something which I believe people like Eric Clapton and well-known blues people have sought to put right. Do you know those kind of people who are the roots of the blues and rock and roll?
Yes, absolutely.
So I'd inadvertently fallen into that. By 76, I mean, I was a gigging person. I was on the road. I was living in Cornwall. I got my own house. I'd got a career. And I kind of thought, well, sod this. I'll do it myself. Then I have no compromises to be made. And I haven't got I can just do what I want, what my heart tells me to do and what I'm kind of used to doing, but I'm going to have to do it in a proper studio. So I got friends who loved the music, loved the songs, and who worked in with me, which are well catalogued now, and it was Rob Lloyd and Johnny Coppin that I'd met down in Cheltenham, and Dick Cadbury, who worked with Steve Hackett Band, and it just led on from there. The first album, of course, being independent, it wasn't really distributed properly or advertised or marketed. But I didn't care. I was a working muso, writing songs and living on the road a lot of the time. And then, of course, I bumped into the festivals.
We'll just pause there and we'll play a track from Ship to Shore.
I'd love to tell you how the name of the label Isle of Light came around.
Yeah?
I was scratching my head going, oh dear, I've got to have a label name. I was touring in Holland going, oh, the album's coming out, with the artist's waiting for a label name.
Yeah.
I've got to ring him up. And I couldn't come up with anything except silly things I didn't like. And I was having a shave one very late morning in Holland after a very late night gig. And the sunlight was blasting in through this cut glass window and making the whole bathroom kind of quite cosmic, and I think I'd been in quite a cosmic state the night before.
Yeah.
I think I'd played at the Milky Way
enough said.
One of the most cosmic gigs on the planet. I'm not sure I ever recovered really from my gigs at the Milky Way, bless them, but that day there was this bathroom seemed to be filled with light coming in through this window. It was full of mirrors that were shafting the light everywhere, and something in my head said, wow, it's just like looking at the sunset on the water back in Cornwall, back home. And the word Isle of Light popped into my head, you know, because we often see islands off the coast here sitting in the sunset, and it's one of the most amazing things you'll ever see on the planet, really. That's what keeps me in Cornwall, so that's where the name came from, Isle of Light.
That was some music from Ship to Shore. You then became fairly well known and fairly well involved in the travelling, touring, and the festival scene, particularly in the 70s. Any good tales from that?
Yeah, absolutely. The solo gigging just led on and on. I was a young man in his 20s, in love with what I did, and I was on the road a lot of the time, and I got asked to play at one or two support spots to more famous people, something that folkies shied away from, really. But I don't think the folkies really took me fully on board, because I insisted on writing my own music and doing weird things. But a friend of mine said there's a free festival south of Glastonbury on a hillside, and it's on the 7th of the 7th, 77. And I'd never been to a free festival. I'd seen one or two folk festivals, Cambridge and the like, and I did have, I was in love with the kind of alternative, complementary fringe movement, if, for want of a better word. I'd met a lot of really fine people who were out there on a mission in life to kind of find other ways of living, if you like. Vegetarianism and organics and environmental matters and empathy with each other and new ideas of ways of making our life on the planet easier. And a lot of them went to these festivals. It was quite a growing movement, and I'd been kicking my heels, being annoyed that I couldn't get to any of them. And so I went to this first one on the 7th of the 7th, 77, and it was a seriously cosmic alternative free Glastonbury festival. And it was mind-blowingly good fun. When I drove up there in my VW, we were in the days when you didn't see many Volkswagen vans, and they weren't trendy and groovy, by the way.
And almost full of them now.
Well, I bought mine because I was told that as I was touring in Europe a lot, it would be like having a Morris 1000 in Britain. Everyone had got spares and could keep you on the road, which is why I got a VW van. I used to get all my spares second-hand in Holland when I went over there. But at this festival, it was a fantastic sight. It was fantastic weather. It was 3,000 or 4,000 gatherings. It was completely free. It only had a tiny stage. When I arrived there, the very first thing I see, and I'm not going to say his name in public, but a very well-known and famous leader of the counterculture movement back in those days, who went on to become one of the leading lights of the very early Green Party in Britain, often to be seen wearing a quite cosmic hippie smoking hat and cropping up in the audience at any questions on TV or... I won't name him because it's not fair. When I tell you the story, you'll understand why. I was trying to work out where to park my V-dub, where I wasn't in anybody's way, and where it'd be cool to just leave it. I'd been on the site 10 minutes looking to where to park, and I spotted a crazy Ferrari going on in front of me. There were a couple of beautiful-looking teepees set up, and just at the side of it, as all these people were arriving, trying to find place to camp and put their tents up, I was met by the sight of a rather large man wielding a very large tent pole, and he was smashing 7 bells of poo out of a continental tent with a family of about 6 people with young children staring on in disbelief and uttering great protests that there they are in the middle of a hippie love and peace festival, and the first thing they get greeted with is a hairy hippie smashing their continental tent to pieces. And the reason he was doing it, allegedly, was because it had been placed too close to his teepee. That might give some of your listeners a clue to who we're talking about, but I really don't want to name him, because I think we'll leave that to people to write the history of the alternative movement. His name will crop up.
Doubtless.
But I don't want to do the guy down. There was a fantastic coach park there, painted in cosmic colours, and I soon connected to them, and I think they were called themselves Sundance. And they were busy with a queue of people outside the coach who was queuing up for Moroccan roll pancakes. I got involved in helping them cook Moroccan roll pancakes for the whole of the Saturday. And we had a queue all day outside the coach because we were just like a production line of chopping the Moroccan up and cooking the pancakes. And suddenly we lost all of our queue. And we'd had a queue going for like 10 hours or something. And we realised we'd lost all of our customers because somebody had parked up another coach and was busy wandering around with a loud hailer, shouting out the words, "Space custard! Space custard!" I saw Stephen Sharpstrings play on a little tiny stage there. I can't remember the band that he was in, but a well-known name from... He's still around, I think... He's something to do with the Here and Now band. But Stephen Sharpstrings was, I think, he he was one of those musicians around the name of bands like Quintessence, renowned for playing seriously off-the-planet lung improvisational stuff with really kind of Steve Hillage early fly-away textures to it.
Yeah.
But it was a fantastic festival. It blew my head off. One of the things that happened there, which was really freaky, which kind of set the tone for later years in my life, was it was my first experience of seeing the persecution of the counterculture. Because I experienced the helicopters from the local RAF base who decided that they would come and show the hippies who was boss. So the helicopters flew over on Sunday morning early and tried to flatten all the tents and teepees. And we were all woken up to find that there were representatives from the Home Office had come at dawn and had busy been walking around the site taking everybody's car numbers. So it was a bit freaky, that.
Yeah.
And it led on, and of course I saw a lot more of that, right up to the current day with the Camelford water poisoning showed me even more of government attitudes. But interesting, you think you're going to a free festival in one direction, and what it ends up is with life presents you with all sorts of new information. And actually it's quite empowering. Festivals are very empowering for a lot of people. And that's partly why the establishment doesn't like them very much.
Yeah, I mean, there's still, I think, people, festivals have become big business now, and I suspect that it's possibly going to come back full circle.
Well, that's not strictly true, because there are actually, just for instance, a few days ago before this interview, I just heard reports of a festival called Sunrise Celebration. It's run by a group of people. It's their seventh year. They have 5,000 or 6,000. It's run as a trust thing for community activity in the Somerset area. It gets licenses no problem, and it's not hugely costly. It's aimed at family, and they've just had one of their best ever years, and they broke even this year.
Yeah, as I say, I think the big fest, the days of the enormous festivals, and it's all become so corporate now.
Well, I have to agree. I'm afraid.
Let's not get into talking about Glastonbury, but
let's not get into talking about where we've arrived that much.
Yes, but I think, yeah, as you say, the small festivals and the ethos is still there, and I think it's gone back full circle potentially, and people are going back to what it's supposed to be about, or what they originally intended it to be about.
Well, I mean, corporate always thinks big is beautiful, equals profit.
Yeah.
People who are driven because they love an art form, or they love having gatherings, or they love anything but the idea of making some profit one weekend. There's still lots of people do that, you know, and I think you know that, John, as well as anyone, because I think you've been involved in similar kind of events yourself.
Yeah, well, I mean, we run our little party, and keep it to a couple of hundred people, and it's it goes down. But people say, oh, you know, this is how it used to be. This is, you know, let's get back to how it used to be, and this is what it's all supposed to be about.
Well, for those people that say that, all I can say to them is, there are festivals like that out there. They're harder to get to hear about because they're tending to advertise locally rather than nationally. So you have to kind of reach into the counterculture's grapevine to find out the news of where and when they're happening. And you have to take pot luck as to whether the vibe will work.
Yeah.
And whether the weather will be good, you know, if it's a good site and the authorities don't hustle them.
Yeah.
So it's a bit take your...
Yes, which is the nature of it. I mean, some of the bigger things, you're fairly... apart from the weather, you're fairly guaranteed that it'll run reasonably smoothly and you'll get to see whoever you've gone to see.
But I've played at a lot of corporate big festivals, and although they provide the facility for the smaller fringe festivals within them, and I'm thinking Glastonbury probably here, Michael Eavies he made great efforts to try and include and be inclusive for everybody, of every kind of ethic and every kind of age group and every kind of artistic requirement. He got well cheesed off with the kind of travelling crusties at one point who took his welcome, which was, I mean, he made them very welcome year after year, but unfortunately and sadly they would quite often get too legless over the weekend and on the Monday morning be aggressive and hungover and the rest of it. And one year, of course, they famously went and burnt down the remains of the market trading area one Monday, and that pretty much wrote off Michael Eavies' empathy or sympathy with the travelling movement, but he had tried, a lot of people, I've seen this before actually, at many of the festivals came to their demise in the early 80s because two things came together. One, a lot of the travellers from the 70s had had children who'd grown up to be young people who'd also become travellers, but they took different drugs and they listened to different music and they liked to drink a lot. When they got completely legless at any free festivals that had made them welcome, they often behaved badly. So, for instance, the very famous tree fair at East Bergholt, that Green Deserts, it was called, that was written off by a travelling crew staying a whole winter in the area and messing up the public relations with the local area, so the licences were never allowed again. And that same year, a travelling crew wrote off the Hood Fair in Devon, which had run for 30 years. They wrote off the Stonehenge Festival. It was basically like the other thing that came together into this equation was Margaret Thatcher and the Thatcherist agenda of let's crush the counterculture and sweep away anything that the 60s brought us. And as you know, and it's the Battle of the Beanfields and the Last Stonehenge, and the counterculture really was attacked, along with the trade union movement and anything else that moved that had working class written on it, or proletariat, or the people, or whatever you want to call it. Thatcher's whole bunch were determined to sweep it away, and of course they did. They swept it away, they repressed it, they crushed it, they persecuted it, and they brought in masses of new laws about gatherings and numbers and stuff on the backs of using the media and the events that happened in the festivals. It made terrible press media coverage to have wonderful, nice people in coaches with kids being pictured with the police holding them up at roadblocks, and the media only presented the negative. I mean, the media ought to be ashamed of themselves, because now here, 20, 30 years on, I look back on what the counterculture espoused and held as its ethics, and I see that pretty much the majority of it is held as mainstream and highly important now. And I'm thinking of things like the words like homeopathic, organic, teamwork, environment, the word green.
Yeah, I mean, it has all completely, whether it's been absorbed or whether it's shifted the mainstream. So, yeah, but as you say, that whole kind of, the festival thing died down in the, but certainly by the late 80s.
Absolutely, and it was crushed.
Yeah.
I was at the last Stonehenge, and I was at three or four Stonehenges before it, and I can tell you, I watched it get crushed.
Mm.
And not just at Stonehenge, but all around the country.
Yeah,
it wasn't entirely the status quo's fault. I mean, they just saw a great opportunity to use bad press to change social conditions for getting festival permission, you know.
Skies silhouette.
the sun looks on. Reach for me, Satana. Like black holes of ice in cold, clear space. In space, from the tips of
some absolutely beautiful tunes there from Nigel Maslin-Jones, and I hope you're looking forward to part two next month as much as I am. Now, I thought we'd play Roy's track Glastow next, in the light of what Nigel said about festivals, and also considering that the Glastonbury Festival has been taking place the last weekend as I record this.
The wind's up and blowing outside, taking us all for a ride. Let's go to Glastow and have us a blast. Oh, see how we're feeling inside. Maybe there'll be summer, maybe it won't rain, maybe it don't matter, glass so again. Michael is running the party, helping us all pay the rent, so that Billy the Kid can just spend a few quid being out of his tree in a tent and watching the bare naked protest. Is the giggly teen girl from Tring. She can't understand how a man could have planned to protest the odd shape of his thing. Maybe there'll be summer, maybe it won't rain, maybe it don't matter. Oh, let's go to Glasgow again, with people as magic as magic as people who see. Freedom as art, art as freedom as art for a week. For the week. Set off in different directions, in various different states, and agreed to meet out of our minds, off our feet in a place where nobody waits. And getting back home to the green fields is more than a day of a slog, and only achieved by osmosis and crisis and feats way beyond any drug. With people as magic as people who see. Freedom as art, art as freedom as art for a week. For the week. Oh, let's go to Glasgow to see. The wind's up and blowing outside, taking us all for a ride. Let's go to Glasgow and have us a blast. Oh, see how we're feeling inside. Maybe there'll be summer, maybe it won't rain, maybe it don't matter. Let's go to Glasgow again, let's go to Glasgow and have us a blast, oh, let's go to Glasgow and have us a blast, let's go to Glasgow again.
Now it's time for the A to Z of Harper, and this month it's the letter W. There are a few possible candidates in terms of tracks beginning with the letter W, but of course I've chosen When an Old Cricketer Leaves the Crease, which is one of the most famous Roy Harper tracks. It still gets played on the radio quite a lot in a sort of cricket-related vein. Now, speaking as a non-cricket fan, I still love the song because, of course, it alludes to the whole life experience of somebody and how you can take stock of your life at the end. And it's a very sort of British song as well. I'll just quickly read out to you what Roy says in his lyric book. He says, "When the day is finally done for the last time and everything remains in a future groundsman's work, there'll still be the imaginary figure of Foxy Fowler pushing a ball to long off across a dry field in Madras for four runs. I sometimes see my grandfather stood at silly mid-on, but it's just a dream because he bowled off spin and probably fielded at third man. Apparently somewhere between about 1898 and 1906, he took 10 wickets in one game for Didsbury in Manchester. My father said that it was against Nelson, who were in the Lancashire League, but I've got no proof of this. But When that moment finally does come, it's a very long moment during which all who see it are allowed to reflect upon their own part in that passage of time and applaud the wonder of their own time's entire innings as mythical footsteps trace the long journey back from the hallowed strip to the eternal pavilion and are written forever into the stuff of legend. I love singing this song.
When the day is done and the ball has spun in the umpire's pocket away, and all remains in the groundsman's pains for the rest of time and the day, there'll be one man his master pushing for four with the skin on a dusty pitch with 2 pounds 6 of willow wood in the sun when an old cricket leaves the creek. You never know whether he's on. If sometimes you're catching a fleeting glimpse of a 12th man at silly mid-on, and it could be Jeff and it could be John with a new ball sting. And it could be me, and it could be thee, and it could be the sting in the ale, sting in the ale. And the clock turns back to reflect on the years of grace as those footsteps trace for the last time out of the act. while the sway of life's recollection, the hallowed strip in the hills, the fabled man and the noonday sun are much more than just yarns of the days when an old cracker leaves the crease. Well, you never know whether he's gone. Sometimes you catch in a fleeting glimpse of a 12th man at sea in the air. And it could be and it could be me, and it could be thee, and it could be the sting in the air, the sting in the air. When an old cricketer leaves the crease, well, you never know whether he's gone. If sometimes you catch in a fleeting glimpse of a 12th man at sea mid on, and it could be me, and it could be thee.
Now for some listener feedback, and the first thing I have is, gosh, horror, actually a voicemail.
Hi Paul, Dave of the Burnham Variety here. Great to hear my old mate Simon Taylor being interviewed, doing it after and during, by the sounds of it, indulging in your home brew in the progtastic pod cave of Davison Villas. I've got to say, I admire Simon's optimism in sending off for the Valentine's booklet 20 years late. And as one of his earliest purchases, I could see Simon's band, the Brown Stripes, covering the Smurf song, if only for the potential stage costumes. Can you imagine? It was very kind of him to recall those sell-out shows we did in Brighton for Roy, but what Simon didn't say was that he worked with me on several of those shows, and it was thanks to him that they were a great success. He spent many a wet and windy night handing out flyers at gigs and putting posters up, as well as appearing on Radio Sussex with me on one occasion. Plus, there was the Gardner Arts Centre gig when Roy broke a string and was going to get Nick to change it, but Simon, who was on the front row, took Roy's guitar and changed it there and then so Roy and Nick could keep on playing together. We also worked on the Heineken Big Top gig in 1993, the deal being that we'd work it if they booked Roy and Nick. It poured down on the Saturday, and Simon very bravely climbed up some slippery, rickety scaffold at the front of the second stage, probably some 20 foot or so above the ground, to bail water out of a bulging tarpaulin covering one of the speaker stacks. He's that sort of bloke, he's really dependable. Fine fellow. If I remember correctly, I think it was in the kitchen at the party at our place that Simon and Steve talked about forming a Tell tribute band. I was already a fan of the Live Bursting Out album, so when I saw the Day Glows live for the first time, I was really impressed, so much so that I organised a short UK tour for them in 1998. Sometime around 1991, I think it was, Simon and I formed the Natural Transport Company for a bit of fun, and occasionally jammed in the basement of my old house. We didn't get as far as Driftwood, and producing a quality, listenable track, my ineptitude held us back a bit, to be honest, but I did record a couple of things, one of which has been playing in the background of this little message. Anyway, bye for now, and don't overdo the homebrew. There's a good chap. Cheers.
Thanks very much for the feedback, Dave. And interesting music in the background there. And I can tell you're an avid fellow podcaster now, because the production quality of your voicemail is quite high. Very good stuff. I also had an email from John Beresford, and I'll just excerpt that. He says, "Hi, Paul. Another great episode. Really enjoy our time of the month. A couple of points. When you ask a guest what their favourite album is, I find myself answering, and it changes all the time. I think that music such as Roy's can run a parallel with our own emotions and experiences, and how I feel at the time might determine my favourite album. Although musically, I must agree that Stormcock is a masterpiece. Also, long, dramatic and emotional tracks. Thanks again, Paul, for your dedication." I also had an email from Keith Bedford, a very long email actually. He sent me all kinds of interesting information about his enthusiasm for pirate radio in the 60s and so on, and we'll get back to a little bit more about that later on. But the main part was, really enjoyed the 23rd podcast and the chat you had with Simon. Still don't agree with you about Dylan, but I won't stop listening because of it. I was impressed, though, with the fact that you roaded once for the Incredible String Band. They, along with Roy, were among my favourite artists of the 60s and 70s and saw them live several times. The last time was relatively recently, about 4 years ago, in Basingstoke. They also even had their third founder member, Clive Palmer, on stage with them. They'd lost none of their magic or superb musicianship. Their album, The Hangman's Beautiful Daughter, is up there in the top five for me, number one being Folk Joke Opus, of course. Keith also talked a bit about the pirate radio days and mentions that Roger Day was one of the people in those early days, one of the defiant DJs who stayed on board Radio Caroline after the law was passed to outlaw it in 1967. And Roger currently plays on the BBC local radio stations, and he managed to grab a very brief excerpt of Roger talking about Roy Harper, which I'll play for you now.
Very underrated, but very good. Roy Harper, with a birthday today. He is 68. He's older than me. That's rare. great talent, though. Used to record for the legendary Harvest label, which that was an effort. John Peel used to like him a lot as well. Roy Harper, and One of Those Days in England. It's sort of quintessential, like, you know, almost Kink-style record, that, isn't it? Very good.
Keith also listens to BBC Radio 6, and they have a brilliant show on Sundays called Freak Zone, which plays the kind of music I like, whether that appeals to you or not, I don't know, from 1730 to 2000. And Stuart McConey also mentioned Roy recently, and once again we have a brief excerpt.
Let's go back then to this splendid record. Her first album, Joanna Newsom's first album of 2004, The Milk-Eyed Mender, clearly established her as something of a reputation when you consider just who's involved in East. Steve Albini, as I say, and Van Dyke Parks, mixed by Jim O'Rourke. And it went on to be mixed to tape and mastered at Abbey Road Studios. The album, apparently, was inspired by the 1971 Roy Harper album Stormcock. And in September 2007, Harper supported Joanna Newsom at the Royal Albert Hall and played Stormcock in its entirety. Interesting. Let's revisit Stormcock maybe sometime on this show. For the moment, though, from Joanna Newsom's East, this is Emily.
The meadowlark and the chimney.
Thanks a lot for those little excerpts, Keith. I really enjoyed listening to those. And Keith's also sent me across a couple of archive Roy interviews, which I may use later on in the year, or maybe early next year on the podcast. Some archive material for you to listen to. And finally, for the feedback section, here is the competition result.
Well, I'm sad to say nobody entered the competition other than Sean, who was the only person to enter and also the only person to name all the tracks, which he did, I think it was either that day or the very next. So well done, Sean, for getting all the tracks named correctly. Sean very kindly didn't want the DVD and wanted it to go to somebody who didn't already have the DVD. So as nobody else entered the competition, I decided to donate the value of the DVD to the Love, Hope and Strength charity that Nick has, for the last couple of years, been raising money for with various epic trips to various epic places. This year, I believe it's Kilimanjaro. I'm sure Paul will post a link to the URL to make donations, and hopefully everybody out there will support Nick's efforts. Now, despite the lack of interest in the competition, I'm sure some of you must be intrigued as to what were the tracks that I took the various wheely bits of Roy from. So, without further ado, the first track was Mars Remains, which was recorded at the Bloomsbury Theatre in 1993. The second track was taken from the BBC tapes, Volume 3, recorded in 1974, and the song was Highway Blues. The third track was Hangman, which was a bootleg recording again, but this time it was the Red Lion Folk Club, which was a gig back in 1984. The reason why I put Saddam Hussein as the clue for that track was that Roy actually put the Hangman track onto his MySpace page the day after Saddam was hung, and it just shows how relevant Roy's songs are and how insightful his lyrics can be. And the last track was One Man Rock and Roll Band, and this was taken from a bootleg called the Madagascan Whistling Cockroach, which is a recording from 1990, which was a number of recordings taken from, I think it was GLC, is it? The London radio station. And it's got a right mixture of stuff, but some of it's very, very funny. So it's well worth trying to get your hands on that one. For the life of me, I can't remember now where I came across this bootleg, but it's very good. And the story behind the Madagascan Whistling Cockroach, well, it's on the bootleg. It'll tell you all about it there. Well, I'm sorry nobody thought it was really worth the effort to have a go at the competition, or maybe I just made it too difficult. But either way, I've enjoyed making it and putting it all together. And once again, well done to Sean for getting the tracks named correctly. So, once more, back to Paul in the studio.
Well, thanks again, Graham, for putting the time in to do the competition. It is a shame we didn't get more entries, but nevertheless, it hasn't put me off. I think we'll do another competition at some point in the near future. Probably make it just a tad easier. Now some brief credits and copyright. This podcast is issued under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives Works 2.0 UK England and Wales license. That means you can share it with others, but you can't change it, claim you made it, or charge for it. The Roy Harper music in this podcast is used by kind permission of Science Friction Limited and is not for copying or redistribution. The Nigel Maslin Jones music in this podcast is used by kind permission of Isle of Light Records, and again is not for copying or redistribution. You can find out more information about the tracks that have been played on this podcast by looking at the show notes. If you go to www.stormcock.net, on the front page there you will see a list of show notes for this episode and others, and I will list the tracks and how and what album they appear on and where you can purchase the albums there. Now, how can you help the podcast? Well, as usual, you can review us, particularly if you're an iTunes user. Apple have a reviewing system there, and you can allocate a star rating to the podcast, and you can also write a brief textual review if you want to. You can also give us donations should you want to throw some money in my direction to help for the hosting and recording of the podcast. No obligation, of course, but there's a PayPal donation button on www.stormcock.net. If you want to send in a voicemail, I love receiving these, as you can probably tell. If you want to email me an MP3 or other audio file, just email me at pd@stormcock.net with that file. Or if you want to use telephone, if you're in the UK, you can call me on 01223 850 282. Or if you're abroad, not in the UK, +44 1223 850282. Please keep those messages to a maximum of 90 seconds, otherwise you get cut off. Okay, that's it for July, and I've managed to keep the running length just below CD length. Hurrah! Great. So next month, we will have the second part of the Nigel Maslin-Jones interview and whatever else crops up. In the meantime, I hope you enjoy the remains of the summer if you're in England, and see you next month. Bye for now.